no evidence that that Mr. Gunn brought, it was not allowed for the witnesses. So to talk about the post-traumatic stress disorder and the history that I've experienced and Children of the Night, the woman that worked with women that were prostituting themselves and children down in Hollywood, she was not allowed. None of my doctors that had treated me during the PTSD and the rape, none of that was allowed. Tim Freer was allowed all the witnesses that he requested.
Welcome back to another episode of Cold Red. I'm Ray Carr, and with me always is Fitz. Fitz, how are you?
I'm great.
Outstanding. Well, we're back with our special guest, Sarah. If you remember last episode, I didn't want to leave, but, you know, we can't stay on forever. But Sarah has this unique background, and we're going to start. We talked about her background, and I'd really like to kind of go back and talk a little bit about Sarah, how the idea of killing Gigi, and whose idea was that? It wasn't yours. So where'd that all come from?
So that came from the boy that I was in a relationship with and a friend of his that was a person that was on parole and had a history of violence. And I guess he just kind of knew the streets as well. So it worked its way out that way.
Did he have an uncle?
That had it's something? An uncle, but it's not like, it wasn't a blood uncle. It was like the uncle in the street. So.
Did he threaten you?
Yes.
Would you care to talk about that or not?
Not as much. For public, private, possibly. I feel like, again, because of the sensitivity of the case.
Okay. Enough said.
I've read some of this and will say you were kind of put in a situation that you almost couldn't get out of. You met with Gigi in a hotel room. He thought for other reasons. And Gigi wound up dying that night. I believe your ID was left, or somehow you were identified with that room. And within about a week, you were arrested, correct?
Yes.
Okay. A very uncomfortable thing to discuss. We know that. Mm-hmm. Here's the man who basically was molesting you starting at the age of 11, trafficking you at 13, and you're about 16 at this point in the hotel room?
Yes, I was 16.
And you committed this act. It wound up with Gigi dying. And 5 days or so, 6 days later, you're arrested. And as a juvenile initially, because you are legally a juvenile, no matter what your fake IDs may have said that Gigi made you get, you're a juvenile. And you're now in the court system. And this is brand new to you. This is, I'm sure, alien to you. I'm not sure if you have an attorney right away. You talk to the police and you wind up confessing, right? You tell them what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And but just the system kicked in from there.
I did not have a fake ID. Gigi was having the conversation with me to move forward with that. But that didn't happen. And it was a work permit that had my name on it for McDonald's.
Oh, okay. But the story itself is, bottom line, is the act happened. You're now in police custody. There's a confession.
Mm-hmm.
Jail cell doors are slamming behind you. And all of a sudden, mm-hmm. your life is as problematic as it may have been before. This is a whole different stage of life for you now. And your coping mechanisms have to kick in a whole different way. Can you tell us, like, what those first few days, first weeks were like? I'm hoping you eventually got a lawyer and someone that was your advocate as a juvenile in the California penal system, even if you're awaiting trial at this point.
Yeah. So I had a 707 hearing. So it was a transfer hearing that first I was held at the juvenile court with the judge, and basically to see what qualified my case to be transferred over to adult court. It was also in the 1990s crime era where children were seen as just predators and horrible kids. So I was transferred over, and I did not have an advocate. I was given a private investigator, Robin Levingston, and she was great. She was getting frustrated with my case too because of the things that she was experiencing. I was handed a public defender, David Gunn, who eventually was appointed to be a California Superior Court in Riverside County, as well as Tim Freer, who was the district attorney prosecuting my case in adult court. He also is a judge as well. I think he was
thankful. A lot of promotions happened after your case, huh?
Yes. I believe Arnold Schwarzenegger also promoted them.
So you're originally arrested as a juvenile, but the 707 hearing, I believe that's California statute, but eventually it's decided you're going to be tried as an adult with special circumstances too.
Yes.
And so first degree murder and at least two special circumstances that there was a robbery involved because you did take some money and car keys, I believe. And also mm-hmm. that you were, quote, you can't see me, I'm using air quotes, lying in wait. And in California statutory interpretation, that brings it up in terms of sentencing possibilities. But without getting there yet, you're in a trial. This goes to trial, right? You pleaded not guilty, and you had a jury and a judge. How many days did the trial last?
2.5 days.
It's pretty quick for a homicide trial.
Yeah, it is.
Did you take the stand?
Yes, I was my only witness that was allowed by the judge.
It's a bold move for the defendant in any type of a case to take the stand. I give you credit for that. I'm sure that the cross-examination was probably difficult, but I'm sure you told the truth as it was. But is it true you couldn't get in any history of your abuse from this guy?
Yes. No, no evidence that Mr. Gunn brought. It was not allowed for the witnesses. So to talk about the post-traumatic stress disorder and the history that I'd experienced and Children of the Night, the woman that worked with women that were prostituting themselves and children down in Hollywood, she was not allowed. None of my doctors that had treated me during the PTSD and the rape, none of that was allowed. Tim Freer was allowed all the witnesses that he requested.
I have to stop you there. You got to excuse my French, but that's bullshit. I can't, for the life of me, haven't been around court systems and seen things. I could see if there was someone sitting on the other side that you were going to testify against, it might be prejudicial. There's nobody there. This is your defense. I can't believe they did not allow that to come in. And look, I'm no lawyer, and maybe there'll be a lawyer that'll come back and say, this is the reason why. Well, by Jove, I'd love for somebody to explain that. That's your whole defense. That's your whole defense, Sarah. That, to me, it's wrong and it smells. To me, it smells. And I think it's wrong. I think you were wrong with it. Now, I'm not saying that what you did was right, but I'm thinking that you didn't have the opportunity to amply prepare and to be able to provide a defense for what happened and why you did what you did. And I mean, even when some of the things that put you in that position, you didn't have the mindset to do that. It was someone else's mindset. That puts you in
adults too, and adults.
Adults, not you. You're a juvenile, and yet nothing happens to them either.
No,
this whole thing stinks. I'm sorry, Sarah.
No, I'm 46 now, so it's been 30 years. Again, the fact that the case never really leaves off of the public platform, to me, continues to say it runs deeper than this, right? And for sure, you know, the judges the judge commented and told my jury, don't be persuaded by an attractive African-American young girl or something like to that effect. To me, looking back in hindsight, I think they knew who he was. They said at the press enterprise that he was a pillar to society. My lawyer started to find out during my writ process that, like, people that were assigned in positions of authority and responsible, right, to hold up certain integrity when it comes to representing cases, they were on pseudonyms online talking about my case, and certain things started to come out from investigative journalists, like, hey, what is this? Why is this happening? My case was transferred from San Diego Appellate Court to San Francisco area. Kamala Harris was the attorney general at the time. It disrupted the courtroom when I got sentenced. And even one of the DAs, his last Curtis, can't remember, but Curtis comes up. He was a district attorney for Riverside, and he was so disturbed over how things were being handled. He had reached out to Geraldo Rivera, and that was like one of the first times that, you know, my case was publicized on Geraldo. But I was also, my mom was also on Montel Williams when it was called Tough Love, which is again really interesting because Montel Williams was Kamala Harris's boyfriend at one time. Excuse me. And
small world.
Not only that small, my attorney's Perkins Coie, the Los Angeles firm, one of the administrative assistants that worked for the firm that was representing me out of LA, the one of the administrative assistant's sister worked for Gigi. So you gotta see, I think this be chills.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it was a lot. And the fact that certain people shut it down or,
They shut you down. Sarah, they shut you down. They shut you down. And then here you are, a teenager, being tried as an adult, and you hear the words, life sentence,
without parole.
Right.
How the heck does that make you feel? What was that moment like? 16 years old, probably 17 at this point.
I was 17 at the time. Mm-hmm. Well, they sent me to YA. So the process was the judge had discretion. And so the practice was that if you were a juvenile and committed a crime that was for an adult sentence, you go to YA for a 90-day evaluation in California. You get seen by parole officers, mental health. You go through a lot of screening. They ask you, you know, questions, and my report came back that they said that I was a child of trafficking. They used the word prostitution, and that I had never been offered treatment. And they recommended to the judge for me to come back and do my YA adult time at YA and be released 25 or 26 because I had a treatment plan. That, I think, would have been ideal. You know, but the judge said no, and he wasn't having it, and he didn't give me 25 to life. He said life without parole, plus 4 years, plus $10,000 restitution for victim fine, and I had to pay court dues. So I think everything that he could have done other than give me the death penalty, he exercised, and for whatever reason.
In the early 90s, the mid-90s, did California 95. Have the death penalty? 95. Did California have the death penalty? I don't know, but you might know. Was the death penalty even in play in 1995?
It was 94 when I got arrested, 95 when I was getting sentencing, and they weren't legally able to give me the death penalty because I wasn't 18. So life without parole was the overturned sentence of the death penalty, which the judge was allowed to give me. And he gave me 4 years for the gun.
You know, I say it's a disgrace. Here, you should have been picking out a prom dress. And instead, they're outfitting you in a prison uniform. I mean, you know, I get what you did was wrong. You said that, but usually the sentence should fit the crime.
Hey, Cold Red fans, Fitz here. Are you interested in a career in criminal justice? You've heard me talk about numerous cases I've worked over the years involving the scientific analysis of language known as forensic linguistics. Well, Pennsylvania Western University now has a fully accredited MA program, which I actually co-develop, where I teach forensic linguistics along with various other excellent professors too. This is the only forensic linguistic graduate program in the world, which is both online and asynchronous. That means the courses are 100% on your schedule. We have professor video recordings, academic readings, and real-life case exercises posted weekly, and you can access any time to review and then complete the week's assignment. If you're interested in learning how written and spoken language can help solve crimes and get a master's degree at the same time, check out the Pennsylvania Western University's Forensic Linguistics Program at www.pennwest.edu/justice.
Based upon the circumstances that were surrounding it.
And the age of the offender.
Yeah, and the age of the offender. And our audience has heard the everything that's going around with this thing. So, I mean, I think this is just a travesty. I mean, I'm sorry. Some people may disagree with me, but, you know, you're 17 years old and someone tells you life without parole. Give me a break. You know, and that's why a few years later, and I say a few, but 10, 11 years later, you know, suddenly there's this bright light that shows up that, hey, there's judicial reform groups that are starting to advocate for you. Tell us about that.
That was more like a snowball effect. That was more like Human Rights Watch was sending in forms for folks to see if you were juvenile, were you sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, right is back. And so that was the onset of communicating, and they were doing this nationally. And so that sparked an interest. And, you know, it was over the years that we just had the in-depth conversation about it. And yeah, people showed up, you know, because it's against the human rights for children. Yeah.
I believe there was a National Center for Youth Law, and also Senator Leyland Lee was a strong advocate for you, if I understand the background of this matter.
Yes, that turned out to be something interesting as well, because it was like there were blocks. He came to the prison, actually picked me up the morning that I was released, and the prison didn't allow him or my family to pick me up. It was very interesting how I was told how I was going to go home. It was wrong. Like the prison, so every prison in the state of California is shut down from 4:15 till count clears, because they have to clear the whole institution, right? All the institutions in the state of California. I was called out of my cell to go up during count to the lieutenant's office. And the lieutenant was sitting there and the AW was there, which was really interesting. They had me call my aunt and they listened to the call on speaker and to tell my aunt that her and my uncle were not allowed to come pick me up. And my uncle flew in from out of the country on my dad's side, my dad's youngest brother. And they said no, that they could not come pick me up, that it was their policy that because I was a high publicized case, that they had to basically transfer custody over to another custody, so the parole office. So that's what they did. And my family didn't understand. And then I was transferred over. So the prison took me to Bakersfield and I was handed off to two parole officers from Orange County. And then they took me to the parole office in Orange County. And by that evening, my picture they took for the parole office was on the news. And, you know, now I really understand the importance of advocating for survivors that come home when I go in as a child and I come out. Because, you know, not everybody's is happy, you know, and I just didn't understand why my picture that was taken at the parole office was on the news that evening. And then also I had an interesting meeting of the Orange County Sheriff's Office when I came home. They came to my house, the transitional home I was living in. And this was like less than a month that I had been out. They came late at night. It was like about 10 o'clock at night. They banged on the door really loud. Scared me to this day. Like, the door knocks. I'm like, you know. And they came in. They said who they were. There was four of them. So three men and one woman. And the three men, like, kind of stood in front of me, you know, with authority. I was sitting on the couch. And the apartment was, you know, had things in the TV. And they were like, oh, that's a nice TV. I don't even have one of those. Why you have all this money on the table? And I was just like, "What? Where did you get the gun from? We want to know." And I kept thinking, like, is this okay? You know, I didn't think this was okay. And I just was like, okay, this is really unsettling. And I had, after they left, I had called my attorney the next day and shared with him, you know, and it's just, I kind of feel that I'm still being watched. Like, I still feel that whoever he knew or whatever the situation, I just feel that some people just aren't really happy. And that was one of the reasons why I recently left California and came to Texas. I feel safer in Texas.
You're one of many people that have made that travel plan out of California. But boy, that's very interesting. You're, within your first month, you have these people knocking at your door late at night. I guess you were, even though you were, Governor Schwarzenegger reduced your sentence with life without parole to life with parole. I want to make sure I have this all right here. But then 25 years when there was basically time served at some point, the 19-year point. And I do know eventually back in 22, Governor Newsom pardoned you, right, in July of 22?
Yes.
That would be a very nice event.
Yes. I feel like that was great. You know, I think that any child who goes in the prison that has similar experiences, definitely, you know, the governor can use his executive authority and make good decisions that way.
Sarah, there are so many victims that are out there that are experiencing things that are probably worse than you, and maybe some not as bad as you. Mm-hmm. You know what? I'm a fan, Sarah, of you, and I have to ask, how did you survive? How did you make it? What did you do? What advice would you give to others? You say, hey, do this or don't do that. What would you say to others that might help them get through what you got through?
Because it's so personal. And I don't know when or if ever I will get to a place where I'm over it, you know? But just surrender. Surrender to whatever comes up. I don't care how ugly, the trauma has to be purged out. And find a safe, you know, safe space to process it. And remember that forgiveness is something that Christ did for all of us. And that helps to root the beauty of humanity's capacity of forgiveness. And I hope to bring that message in the policy, in reimagining policy, because I know that people, you know, want to separate their belief when it comes to faith, but I know it was nothing but Christ's love that helped me through moments that I should have never made it through.
Divine mercy.
Absolutely.
Divine mercy. 100%. It really is. You know, you were able to transform your life, and now you dedicate it to both your community and other child victims. Let's jump over and let's talk about Sarah's Law. That's something you jump right into upon your release. How can our listeners learn more about Sarah's Law and support that?
Yes, it's with Westerman, and it's on the federal, you know, legislative piece, and it's in to add into the TVPRA, which the TVPRA is amazing legislation already. To have it be retroactive would be very effective when we move forward with legislation. But I think if people want to vote on it, is basically to have the conversation with the people in the position that's going to give the yes or no. Like, yeah, we should pass this. It's kind of clear why we need to have legislation in place in state and federal level, because that's where the confusion comes in. In the democracy of the United States, the socially constructed reality of the culture is represented usually with red, blue, independent, right? And they're dominating. But the concern is that old values allow policy to allow trafficking. So once we as a country really understand that the state legislations and the federal legislations need to support one another, no matter what, when it comes to children, then we can be in alignment with the human rights, you know, international laws that America has not taken an advancement to ratify. So again, there's a three-point piece to that. Policy is passed down based on the highest legislation. And if our constitutional law doesn't protect children and isn't in alignment with the international laws that protect children, then that gives the republic a have at it when it comes to state legislation, because the way that democracy is set up.
You mentioned his name. I believe it's an Arkansas House of Representative congressperson named Bruce Westerman, who is the sponsor of this bill. I don't have the HR number attached to it, but let's hope all sides can get on board with Sarah's bill, Sarah's law, and come up with something related to that. I mean, it's also known as the Child Sex Crimes Victims Protection Act, and I guess that's the official name of it. And let's hope we get a lot of support to that for everyone. I don't think this country's helping itself right now with the open borders over the last several years. Rumors are a lot of human and sex trafficking taking place. That's for a whole other episode, perhaps. But I think, and there's movies like The Sound of Freedom out there now and others that are, you know, slowly bringing, everyone's vision into these types of problems that have been going on probably for centuries, but certainly enhanced now even more with the internet, international crime, organized crime, like was right in your own neighborhood, no doubt. And who knows how expansive that was, why some of these judges' decisions and prosecutors' decisions played out the way they did. I was waiting to hear Jeffrey Epstein's name come up somewhere in your case, a trip to an island somewhere. But at least so far, there's no connection there. But this is... this has been a truly amazing and eye-opening story for me, Sarah, and I so much appreciate. If I may ask just a few things in closing, if you're willing to talk about this, you're married with a child?
So I came home when I was married. Yes, I've been separated and filed for divorce many, many years. And yes, I do have a daughter.
May I ask how old?
She's 9.
Again, if you're okay with this, just a shorty answer even at some point, or does she know much about your past? Will you tell her? Will she listen to this podcast? I don't know. Yeah. But how will you address that? How have you, or how will you address that with her?
So she's very inquisitive and very smart. And I think that personally, our journey is ours, you know, it's going to ebb and flow. I think just with the depth of that kind of conversation, I'm very protective, and of course, you know, that's
I think of a lot of people out there are just like you. They have a little one, and I think in time, you will find a way to bridge the information that works best for both of you. Mm-hmm. But you know, you talked about a journey, and I have to ask, where are you in your journey to healing? And a lot of people, you know, that are victims of prostitution and human trafficking, I mean, when you look at that as well, and victims of abuse, I mean, current and past, what do you say to them in reference to your journey? And how are you how would you explain to them, this is how I'm reacting and adjusting to this? If you'd like to share.
No, I think that that's exactly a healthy factor to be a part of this conversation, because my level of awareness was limited when I paroled in 2013. So I was a lot more confident. I felt a lot more secure. I didn't constantly talk about the trauma that I had experienced while I was in prison. There was a whole bunch of new trauma being created that, right, again, was separate, right, but relatable. So I'm not going to move forward in conversation with folks and paint this pretty picture, because it's ugly. It's so ugly that it is like nothing but God's grace. Because I feel that humans have the natural response to judge anything that doesn't align with their personal values. And so compounded and complex trauma, it doesn't have any values, because it's the memory of what that rape felt like, or it's the memory of the way that your skin felt, or it's the memory of, right, experiencing very uncouth experiences that to like go against your innate moral compass. So, you know, tackling on top of what happened prior to going to prison, the types of abuses and the domestic violence and the sexual abuse, or the the relationship dynamics that happen inside of prisons, the power loss of dynamics, all of that pulled together, and then reintegrating into a society that's kind of lost its own set of values, yeah, right? You talk about cognitive dissonance. You're shattered, rebuilt, shattered, rebuilt, shattered. You get to a point where you're like, whatever Jesus says, I'm going to put it at his feet, because there's no way that it's ever going to make sense. And that's okay too. It's grieving it. And however that grieving process, it's personal. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. It's a loss over loss over loss over loss over loss over loss. Yeah. And you have to feel it. You have to feel it.
I would only hope that maybe conversation such as this with us in this one instance, but certainly with others. And I would hope writing the book, and we'll mention it again, I Cried to Dream Again, with Corey Thomas, it had to be cathartic to some degree in terms of this rebuilding process. And I get it. You rebuild, take a step back, rebuild maybe a little more, two steps back, maybe a whole lot more some other day. And I'm hoping there is some cathartic sort of ongoing experience that you're living through now, that between Sarah's Law that we talked about and trying to make life better for others so they don't have to go through what you went through, or if they already have, to help them, you know, mitigate it or minimize it to some degree. Mm-hmm. I see that. I mean, just talking to us tonight, and I know lots of people are going to hear this, and they'll empathize or sympathize with your situation, but I know they're going to be wiser for it, and they're going to look at this situation much more seriously, and they're going to want to support all this legislation we're talking about, and to include individuals such as yourself. I'm so glad you got a second chance at life. You lost 19 years of it in prison. Maybe some of it should have been there. That's a whole other debate. but not quite that much, certainly not anywhere near that much. And I'm glad you're out now. And I hope you're a better person for it. I only you know inside if you are. From what I see, you know, you're very much a stand-up person.
I'm convinced, Sarah. I'm convinced. You know,
we don't convince easily, do we, Ray?
No, we don't. But I'm going to tell you, in my last thought in this whole thing, if I could reach out through this screen and touch every listener that was a victim, either past or current, and give them your energy and your strength, they would do extremely well. You are an unbelievably strong person. Don't ever let anybody tell you you're not. You know, and I know you got Jesus in your corner. I get that. He's there, you know. I mean, but, and maybe that's why. But I'm going to tell you, you know, you light up a room. You lit up this room. I'm telling you that right now. And I'm telling you that I pray that people look to you. I pray they reach out to you. Do you have a website, Sarah?
Just Human Rights for Kids. That's the work that the organization I work with. Yeah. It's out of D.C.
Yeah, I hope they go to that. I hope that they go to that website and reach out to you. I hope they do. And I hope they continue to do that. And I hope people around the world continue to come to you because you're a beacon of light. You really, really are. Your story is a beacon of light for so many others. And you don't understand, I think, how much you're going to help other people. Even if you only help one person.
Yeah.
That's one person that wasn't helped before. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
If I could end it with the German philosopher Nietzsche, this is pretty well known, but his expression was, that which does not kill you only strengthens you. And euphemistically speaking, some people really tried to do you in, but you built strength after strength after strength, Sarah, on top of that. And you are a survivor. And again, thank you for gracing Cold Red with your presence over two episodes. And I have a feeling some lives of people out there will be made better just having listened to this. I already feel that mine has, and I'm perhaps looking at some aspects of life in a different way. So I can't thank you enough. So again, for all that you've been through and another work you're still doing. Ray, any final words on you?
No, Sarah, on Cold Red, there's an open door. And if you don't mind, I'm going to share your information with people that run human trafficking conferences and things of that nature and get your name out there, because I think your story and your strength, I mean, you, like I said, you lit up a room. I'm telling you, I'm not easy to mesmerize, and I'm mesmerized because I think it's remarkable. I think it's remarkable. I think the adversity you faced was amazing. And I'm very proud to say, I know you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Same here. Folks, on that note, again, Sarah, thank you. Thanks for listening or watching this episode of Cold Red. Check out the coldredpodcast.com website. Check us out on social media. Subscribe if you can. And we will see you next time with yet another very interesting guest. Thanks again, folks. Thanks, Ray. And thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Jim. Sarah.